Hi, this is John Udell, and today's podcast is an interview with Steve Burbeck. If you follow web services, you may know Steve as one of the authors of the UDDI specification. He's been the director of computing and statistics at the Linus Pauling Institute of Science and Medicine, co-founded a startup that pioneered Smalltalk for the IBM PC, worked at Apple Computer in object-oriented development tools, and also was VP of development and operations at Knowledge Systems Corp., again doing object-oriented design and consulting. Nowadays, Steve's retired from IBM, where he spent about 10 years working on object technology and then in IBM Research on adaptive and self-configuring systems. We got together to talk about an unpublished paper of Steve's on the topic of multicellular organisms and what they may be able to teach us about managing complex information systems.
Steve, you've written this essay about complexity and multicellular computing. And why don't you give us a sense of, first of all, where that comes from in terms of your background, both in IT and with life sciences, and then we can get into where you think it can go and should go.
Okay. Well, the where it comes from is, oddly enough, it is related to object-oriented stuff and small talk and all of that kind of thing.
Doesn't seem odd to me.
Well, it does seem odd to a lot of people, because an awful lot of people who are involved in OO lightly or lately, however you want to put it, are not steeped in object-oriented analysis and design and don't see the world as a whole bunch of, the world meaning in the computing, as a whole bunch of collaborating objects. If you do see the world as a whole bunch of collaborating objects, then it's not a big leap to say, that's a little like a whole bunch of collaborating cells in a biological organism that are busy sending messages and all that kind of stuff.
Right. And so given your deep background in Smalltalk, that would be an obvious way for you to think about things.
Exactly.
Smalltalk is just this kind of soup of objects that message one another, right?
Yes. And furthermore, in the early days of it, in, I've forgotten, early 72 or so, Alan Kay wrote a paper talking about objects, and at that time he sort of envisioned that what was really intended to be was every object was a separate computer. But of course that's not even physically possible. Well, maybe it is today, but it certainly hasn't been physically possible until quite recently, and it wasn't at all possible in a single CPU, which is what Smalltalk really developed in.
Mm-hmm.
But that was one of the original ideas.
Mm-hmm.
That they would be asynchronous, completely independent, messaging each other. But anyway, some of the people early in Smalltalk were thinking along these lines, and voila, somewhere around the late 90s, it occurred to me that with the Internet and all these computers talking together and sending little packages of whatever, HTML or whatever around, that we're there, that it's doing sort of what Alan Kay originally envisioned Smalltalk to be doing. In a very odd way. I mean, it certainly wasn't small talk or object-oriented, but it has a lot of similarities.
So it's a really attractive thing to think about, the fact that that is indeed happening. It's a very seductive analogy,
mm-hmm.
but it's also probably a dangerous one in some respects, right? If we're not really clear about what in practice that means in terms of software systems as opposed to biological ones, you know. So
although it is even more dangerous to not think about it at all, because we are getting the virus storms and all sorts of crap in the internet as a result of not thinking about this issue.
Yeah.
So I don't know which is worse. But I do know that it's a lot harder to try and figure out what an architecture should be, because these collaborating systems of objects or computers or cells are mind-bogglingly complex.
Mm-hmm. So you've carved out, I'm not going to say recommendations, but anyway, a set of areas for future development. So why don't we kind of run through what those are?
The four fundamental metaphors or analogies or however you want to look at it between what I see going on in multicellular computing, by that I mean not just, but largely highly networked computing with all sorts of machines doing their little bit. The four basic principles that seem to me to transfer across well enough to make it worth thinking about them are specialization, which sounds trivial. I'll get to it in a minute. The notion that messaging cannot and must not include executable code. It's just too dangerous. So in effect, object-oriented messaging, or the messages are, the meaning of the messages is are determined by the receiver, is the fundamental point. In OO, that's called polymorphism, but in cellular systems, it's just a fact of life. Multicellular organisms do not send code around. So,
what would be an example of, if they did, what would be an example of that?
Well, in soups of single cell organisms, in pond water and that kind of stuff, they do. They pass little bits of DNA around and, in effect, share behavior. But that behavior is sort of chemistry behavior. It's how to metabolize some new pollutant in the water and stuff like that. So in single cell systems, passing code around does make sense. It's just that in a multicellular system, the code is viruses, basically, and that's exactly what we're seeing in the Internet.
So are you saying that in the multicellular world, there was at one time code sharing and it was selected against?
You mean in biological?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, who knows? That is my speculation. Almost certainly, well, I guess the answer is yes, because the earliest kinds of multicellular organisms weren't specialized in the sense of one single sperm and egg getting together and creating an organism in which every cell in the organism has the same DNA. It was stuff called biofilms is one of the typical words used today, which like the scum on rocks in a stream or your dental plaque or pond algaes and things like that, where they do specialize temporarily to collaborate in a film, etc., but they are still single-cell organisms, and they do still have mechanisms to pass around DNA the way they would if they were free-floating in water. So,
okay.
Yes. Maybe I went too far into the biology there. But the point is, yes, the first stage of multicellularity, where it's a whole bunch of cooperating single-cell organisms, something like the web today,
mm-hmm.
They did still pass around DNA. Presumably, it was selected against because all of the full-blown multicellular organisms don't do it.
Okay.
But that's a deduction. We can't prove
it. So message passing is an adaptive thing?
It's adaptive in the sense that a cell can't be hijacked by a protein message or an HTML message if it's a computer,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
because the receiver, this is the polymorphism again, the receiver determines what it's going to do when it receives that message, not the sender. Hijacking is when the sender determines what's going to happen.
Okay.
Which is what viruses do.
Okay. So this is a justification for a strict message passing communication strategy in networked computing.
Right.
Okay.
And if you just look at what's happening in the real world, it doesn't take much justification. You allow code to go around, and boxes get hijacked.
Hmm. Okay.
So anyway, the third principle...
Wait, what was the second?
The second is message passing. The first is specialization.
Okay.
That when you go multicellular, you don't just collect together a whole bunch of general-purpose boxes that could do anything that happened at this moment to be doing just the right thing in this multicellular collaboration,
mm-hmm.
Although that is what the biofilm world does. They specialize. Secondly is the message passing, which means polymorphism, which means the receiver determines the semantics. Third is an odd one, which is subtle, and the only name for it is stigmergy, which comes out of the study of social insects, ants, termites, and things like that.
And this is the interaction between, or the way in which behavior is made persistent in the surrounding environment, right?
Yes.
Or the interaction between environment and behavior.
Right. So the insects are the best way to put it. They build an anthill or a termite mound or a bee's honeycomb and all that kind of stuff. And in the process of building that, the things they do passes on information to other ants, termites, whatever, in the passive environment,
mm-hmm.
by leaving down trails of pheromones and that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the general notion is that there is a persistent structure that, you know, lives over time and space, and that information left on it by the actions of whatever, cells or insects, later influences the behavior of other cells and insects. And that process is called stigmergy, which is an awkward name.
It's an awkward name, and it's an obscure scientific phenomenon on the one hand, but on the other hand, it's completely obvious, I think, to everybody that that's exactly what the web is to us right now.
Yes, absolutely. Well, the web as a yes, I guess that's true. The web as a whole, sort of loses some of the interest, but sub things in the web, such as a wiki, is an absolutely obvious stigmergy structure.
Yeah.
The Linux source code, the CVS tree, is another obvious stigmergy structure. Databases are stigmergy structures that we all deal with, in that, you know, one computer puts some data in the database, other computers search it and act differently according to what they find. So the database becomes a stigmergy structure. And
well, I'd argue that it does apply to the web as a whole, because exactly the power of Google is reflecting our own behavior.
Yes.
Back to us, right?
But without Google, it was a pretty useless stigmergy structure. It's just so big. But yes, Google is taming it, or not just Google, but searching.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of behaviors like that are taming it such that the entire web becomes a stigmergy structure, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so the point in the paper that I make is that we think that multicellular organisms are thought of as defined by the cells, but they're really defined by the stigmergy structure. That the human body, for instance, with the exception of some nerve cells, all of the cells regenerate. They don't live very long. Blood cells are only 7 days.
Mm-hmm.
You know, muscle cells are a year or two or three. I don't know. I haven't looked up all this stuff. But the point is that the cells come and go, and what persists is all of the extracellular matrix that these cells have made, your tendons, the bones, the skin, all sorts of stuff that is not living, that was made by the cells and then thereby organized the behavior of the newer, younger cells.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not a collection of cells. We're more a stigmergy structure, more a termite mound, more this structure that's inhabited by all sorts of cells, and the organization of them takes place largely within the stigmergy structure. And that has to be the way we think about designed or controllable multicellular computing systems.
And so to the extent that we do think about things that way, what does it lead us to?
The thing that I have used as an organizing principle in thinking about the web and things like that is to say that the cells or the sort of emerging organisms that are coming out of this soup of gazillions of computers talking to each other are defined by the stigmergy structures, not the computers. So if you want to figure out what's going on in the web, go out and look for stigmergy structures.
Mm-hmm.
So Flickr, for instance, created a whole new structure of tags and photos. And that, by virtue of creating that stigmergy structure and then, of course, enticing enough people to participate, you have organized a whole new kind of thing, of organism. We don't know where it's going to go because it's only, a couple years old? I don't remember when it started. And all sorts of new ways to use that are coming to people's minds. But the point is, so look for the stigmergy structures, not the individual behaviors of machines.
So I guess one question is what you call a stigmergy structure something which only emerges, or rather something which can be designed, obviously, or I would say arguably in the case of Flickr, it was designed?
Yes, it was designed in the sense that all databases are designed, but the structure, the behavior that emerged around it, I would argue probably was not exactly designed. They had a notion that they wanted a whole community to form, but they didn't have a notion of what it would do.
Right. It was designed, though, with enough of the foundations and the necessary flexibility so that a range of things could emerge. And that kind of gets to a question that's pretty interesting to me around web services, which is, you know, this might all sound pretty far-fetched to a hard-nosed enterprise architect who's trying to sort out his, you know, WSDL relationships with, right, with business partners.
Yes.
You know, but
well, he gets to UDDI eventually.
Right. But, you know, I mean, one thing I've always been pretty clear about is that, you know, assuming that we sort of solve those kinds of basic interactions and have a, you know, vocabulary of objects, if you will, that we can exchange. And there's tons of work to be done there, but, you know, I don't really think that that's in itself kind of the end game, you know, because those transactions need to be embedded in a context. And that context is, in a lot of ways, created by the participants in the processes, mm-hmm, as much as it is designed by the implementers of the systems that run the processes. And so the burden is then on the designers of those systems, you know, not to presume that they can understand all of the context that's going to be created by the participants,
right,
but to make available the means by which those participants can kind of collectively figure out for themselves what it is that they need to persist into the environment, if you will, you know, to build the context that guides the less mechanical aspects of you know, web service transactions, right? The exception handling is one of the ways that I like to talk about it, right? That, you know, mm-hmm, at the end of the day, it's, you know, the exception handling isn't a BPL script that unwinds a transaction. It's somebody with some domain expertise that is not probably in our lifetimes ever going to be captured formally.
Right? Yes, probably not. I like the notion of exception handling because that has always been the thorn in the side of what was otherwise thought of as neatly architected and designed systems. Smalltalk, for example, but many others, Java, for instance, is that you have this nice flow of control and process that is designed, and then you start putting on the exception stuff, and you realize that all of the various paths have gotten out of control, in effect. Once you have all sorts of stack unwinding and exception handling, you no longer can quite tell what's going on in the system. And mm-hmm, in web services, that's going to be the same thing, probably in spades.
Mm-hmm.
So you have the main flow, which your WSDL can define relatively neatly, or at least one hopes it can. And then you have the exception flows, where suddenly you realize you don't know how it works. And so that is a problem in web services, and probably will grow.
Right. So, you know, from my perspective, the way to think about attacking that problem is to observe that there are human beings, there are domain experts who can't articulate what they know,
mm-hmm,
but who can act on what they know.
Right. So you can make a web service with that human as one of the services, in effect. And some web service systems have that, where one of the nodes is really a human interfacing through whatever WSDL is defined as how you talk to that human that solves some problems.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, this might be stretching it a little bit, but from a biological perspective, I think in terms of white blood cells, right, you know, that you get this kind of swarming behavior, ideally, right,
mm-hmm,
when something goes wrong and a bunch of, white blood cells are alerted to the fact that something has gone wrong and they converge on the site and they try to do something about it, right? That's very much what we'd like to have happen in business processes.
Right.
You know, and to the extent that that is the scenario that we envision, I guess, you know, to me it seems like the problems are, well, what kinds of messages need to be circulating in the system? What sorts of notification, what sorts of filtering, what sorts of, you know, awareness propagation mechanisms are going on in the biological system that allow this convergence to happen in a really natural way?
And that, although, that brings me to the fourth principle, incidentally, although it's not a perfectly congruent principle with what you just said. It's closely related. And that is that multicellular systems, real multicellular organisms, have this thing called programmed cell death or apoptosis, although that the apoptosis is odd because the Greek it would be apoptosis, but the biologists mostly seem to pronounce the T. So anyway, it's A-P-O-P, well now I can't even remember how to spell it. Anyway.
Cellular suicide.
Cellular suicide, which is a nicely formed messaging protocol in which every cell in a multicellular, let's talk about humans, every human cell in the organism, and the reason I say that is because 10% of our cells are actually bacterial cells,
mm-hmm.
which most people don't know, but anyway, and they don't quite participate in this, or at least they don't in the same way. But all of the human cells sit on a knife edge, in a sense, between functioning normally and killing themselves. And that knife edge is tipped by two systems of messages. One says, you're okay, you're cool. It's the I'm okay, you're okay messaging system in the body,
mm-hmm.
which when everything is right, the cells are told, you're great, don't kill yourself. And in many cases, all that has to happen is for something to change such that they don't receive those messages and they say, whoops, something's wrong, I better die. And the classic case is attachment. Most of the cells in the body, not in the blood, but in the harder structures of the body, are attached to the extracellular matrix. And their messaging system, their self-suicide messaging system, is such that if they get detached one way or another, they cease to get those messages and they immediately kill themselves. So that's one reason that cancer does not proliferate until late in the disease, when the cancer cells have mutated to the point where they've disabled the cell suicide. Then they can float free in the blood and metastasize and create new tumors elsewhere in the body. But in the early stages, if they get detached, they kill themselves.
What's an example of a cell getting detached?
Well, wounds is a classic case. So when you cut yourself, all sorts of cells get knocked loose that would be floating around in the body and not be where they're supposed to, so they just kill themselves.
Okay.
In the lab is where you find this the most. When you try and grow human cells or multicellular organism cells, in cell culture, they don't grow because they're not attached properly, and so they just all kill themselves.
Okay. So what would be the useful equivalent of this mechanism in the computing realm?
I don't have good ideas on that because you have to have evolved this whole mutualistic system of cells telling each other you're okay, and trying to figure out how to create it out of whole cloth is difficult. But consider in a corporate IT infrastructure where the boxes are supposed to be connected to the corporate network, and that as long as they are connected and you have heartbeat messages coming out, whatever, once a second, you're okay, everything's fine. And then you take one of those boxes and detach it from the network. Well, the corporate security people are often freaked about that because what happened, you know, say the machine was stolen, what happens to all the proprietary information on it?
Mm-hmm.
And the way that we've tried to deal with it is with passwords and, you know, all sorts of not very effective schemes. Suppose that the box itself was designed that if it was detached from the network, it just self-destructed. Not in hardware, but in software.
or perhaps became temporarily
locked so that nobody could do anything with it, and you have to reattach it in some presumably elaborate ritual that involves passwords or whatever to make sure you're doing the right thing, and then it comes back alive.
So all of this is under the rubric of complexity or managing complexity.
Yes, that's sort of the theme that underlies a lot of what I wrote.
Okay.
And the reason being that I've been fascinated by complexity theory and emergent phenomena and all that kind of stuff for the last 15 years, and so it naturally fits in. But the other reason being that, look, these systems evolve to become more and more complex all the time, both biological and computing systems, so you'd better understand that.
Right. Now, one of the things that we discussed in email is that it's quite difficult for human minds to encompass many levels of abstraction.
Right.
Maybe impossible for us to do that.
I argue that it is, that it's impossible for us to manage more than three levels of abstraction at the same time. Now, we can manage lots of levels of abstraction, it's just we can't think about them together without, more than three of them. So, for instance, you may know, I've been in computing for a long time, so I actually used to wire wrap chips together to make drivers. So I understand how it works at the bit or actually wire signal level. I know how machine language stuff works. I've written lots of assembly, all the way up to small talk. I can think about any one of those. I'm rusty at a lot of them, but I can think about any one of them. But when you're trying to do serious design or debugging, you're trying to think of multiple things together and trying mm-hmm. to figure out how, you know, where the interaction's going wrong. And at that point, we're trying to actually think about them at the same time. It's hard to do more than the central level you're looking at, plus one level up and one level down.
It's really hard, and one of my observations is it's not just hard because it's mentally difficult to be aware of multiple levels at the same time, but also because there's this psychological problem of needing to believe in something, right? Like, I can't question every assumption up
right.
and down the stack because I'll just go crazy, right? I have to think that there's some solid ground.
But if you pick a solid ground at one level and you think about it long, this is in debugging more is what I'm thinking about. I don't mean this just software, but a system.
Yeah.
If you think about it at one level and you're willing to grant that the stuff below it's okay, and maybe even the stuff above it, for a while, and you get nowhere, I at least, at some point, switch and say, okay, that level's not where the problem is. So I'll move to a different level and think about that for a while. And
right.
Now I'm assuming that the other levels are sort of stable and okay.
Right, right.
Right. And that's difficult.
It is indeed. But so is part of what would come out of this, in your view, that we're never going to have this kind of ability to globally understand things,
yes.
and that we will definitely be creating systems that are going to be producing emergent behaviors that we can't understand.
Absolutely.
And so, therefore, the reason for studying these principles and thinking about them and trying to understand which ones we should apply and how we should apply them is that that's really the only way we can do stuff is to use what we think are the right principles, accepting the fact that what gets created on top of them is going to be in some ways incomprehensible
mm-hmm.
to us, even in principle.
Yes. And it's twofold. Yes, just our abilities are insufficient. But the other part of it is that when a new level emerges, so you have the level of individual computers that have web browsers and HTTP and IP stacks and all this kind of crap on them. And then you put a whole bunch of them together and they start interacting. That the cause and effect between what you change at the IP stack of course that's all pretty well fixed now, but suppose this stuff is changing because we need new IPv6 or web 2.0. There are changes coming down the pike. That when we change those things, that the cause and effect link between that and what the next level up is going to do isn't just too difficult for us to think about. It actually emerges because of positive feedback loops.
Mm-hmm.
So it's literally unpredictable. It isn't a matter of can we mentally encompass it. It's that it hasn't even happened yet. And as conventions form that then feedback positively on the IP stack people, et cetera, it emerges, and a whole new level emerges that was not predictable. Once it's emerged, you might be able to understand it, but you could not say in advance what was going to emerge out of it.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, it's fundamentally, there's no way we're going to understand all of the systems.
Well, you know, given that we do hope to do the right thing and avoid doing the wrong thing, what's the strategy then, or what are the strategies, or how do we at least move in the direction of figuring out what the strategies should
well,
be?
Well, I don't believe I understand this and know the answer to that. But what I'm proposing in this paper is that you want to try and make explicit and think about the four principles. Mm-hmm. Have you specialized the various devices properly, or turn it around? Have you left general purpose behavior at a level that really shouldn't have it because it's just going to cause you trouble? In other words, have you not sufficiently specialized? Hmm. Have you made sure that your messaging is polymorphic, meaning that the semantics are determined by the receiver?
So but hang on. I just want to replay that first bit because I think that's interesting. So you're saying that a possible guiding principle here is to avoid too much general purpose capability.
Yes.
Because it's dangerous.
Because
it causes trouble.
Because it allows many more kinds of unexpected emergent behavior.
Hmm.
The more general the individuals are, the more difficult it is to figure out what putting a whole bunch of them together is going to do you.
Hmm. That's an extremely interesting and perhaps controversial thing because because how do you know what to subtract?
Well,
or what
yes.
the consequences will be if you subtract the wrong thing, right?
Absolutely, and in fact, that you've hit exactly the right point. Subtractive specialization is infinitely more difficult because you never know who's relied on. Word, it's a classic example. Microsoft was pilloried 10 years ago or so for feature bloat in Word. And even Microsoft agreed at one point, gee, you know, it'd be nice if it was simpler because it's mm-hmm. just too hard for everyone to learn.
Mm-hmm.
But then they tried to say, okay, people, what could we remove without causing trouble? And the answer was everyone had a different set of behavior they took that they needed.
Mm-hmm.
And basically there was nothing you could take out
mm-hmm.
that wouldn't cause serious trouble for some part of the base. But that's the problem of subtractive specialization. What we need is additive specialization in that we start some new system, say, for example, which I think I sent you an email on yesterday, the new $100 laptop scheme
mm-hmm.
that MIT is doing.
Mm-hmm.
So start it very simple and add what's necessary. Don't start at general purpose and try and later subtract it.
Mm-hmm.
Cell phones is another classic case, although it may be already too far gone.
Although I would have to, I mean, the $100 computer, I would say, is a relatively general purpose device, right? I mean, it has, you know, presumably a Linux operating system.
It has a part of a Linux operating
system. It can run a broad range of applications. Or, I mean, like what,
Well, the CPU is fundamentally general purpose, so yes, in that sense. But the question is, in the way you set up the operating system, the way you set up the loading of new software, et cetera, determines how general purpose it can be. If
mm-hmm.
the philosophy is the same as we currently have with PCs, in general, is that there are nice mechanisms for sticking anything you want on them, and furthermore, there's broadcast mechanisms for getting them out there all over the place, then yes, it will become very general purpose very quickly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But the hardware is not as general purpose. I don't know what's going to be on that box, but it's not going to have oodles of USB ports and microphones and speakers and, you know, high-powered video graphics generators and all that kind of stuff. So just because of the $100 price point, the thing is going to be more special purpose than a regular PC.
Okay.
Whether that's enough special purpose or not, I don't know.
Right. I see what you mean, though. That's very interesting.
So the main point is that I agree with you. Trying to make specialization by subtracting behavior runs into the marketplace. It's not going to work.
Or it's not going to work in the first world.
Yes. So imagine, for instance, that your UPS have all of their people with a special purpose device already.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how special purpose they are. I've never looked into them. and maybe they have all sorts of general purpose crap in them that we don't know about. But they've started with an ecology of tens of thousands of people with special purpose devices, and you could grow that by carefully adding behavior to support the multicellular UPS system, like a GPS device in every one of their little handheld things that you sign when they bring the thing to the door. They could add a GPS device into that so that they'd always know where everyone is. They may already have done this, I don't know. But they could slowly add behavior to form a multicellular organism that's specialized for UPS. And never go through the starting with every one of their drivers having a Windows box that then is full of viruses and, you know, crashes all of UPS.
I suppose so, although another take on that would be that if they had a kind of very general purpose hardware, which, you know, could be reprogrammed to do a variety of things which weren't originally anticipated, then they wouldn't have to rev their installed base. They could, but this gets back to your, this is, you know, now contradicting your fear of distributable code, right?
Which brings up, by the way, the question you had in an email about versioning and how does that fit into all of this?
Yeah. What I was wondering there is are there any examples from the world of biology that speak to the versioning issue?
Cell world, yes. In the multicellular world, no.
Really? So what's a version in the single-celled world?
When they pass a little chunk of new DNA around, which it may do nothing. It may kill the other cell, or it may do something really cool, such as protect them, or not protect, but help them defend against antibiotics.
Okay. So when I accept new DNA, I become a new version of me.
Yes.
If I'm one of these things.
Right. Right. You become something new. And okay. In the single cell world, that's fine because it's just rampant Darwinian evolution. You accept something that wasn't cool, you're dead.
Right.
End of story. And the ones that accept something that turns out to be valuable start to proliferate and take over the slime pool and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Works great. Multicellular organisms, you get your full complement of DNA when the egg is fertilized. End of story.
Mm-hmm.
No versioning.
Right, and then the relevant domain of reprogramming is the cultural domain at this point.
Yes.
Right?
I mean, yes.
So, yeah.
Memes, memetics, and all of that is an entirely different world that is not, it is Darwinian, but it's not Mendelian, meaning...
Yes.
You know what I mean. Okay.
Yes.
And yes, whole different world. And that world, by the way, has Digmergy structures, even has some sorts of apoptosis or suicide, meaning that there are certain meme structures, certain belief systems, certain religious whatevers that, say, lead to suicide bombers.
Yep.
I mean, that is a mimetic suicide mechanism.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What are the next steps for you? Where are you going with this, or where would you like to take it?
I think where it's going is we need to get a conversation with lots of people that can grow.
Mm-hmm.
Because the implications of this are huge, but who knows what they are yet. I can't come up with a prescription that says, just do this and your multicellular IT systems will be fine.
Right.
I believe these four principles are central to it, but there will be more, and there's going to have to be bringing it down to practical step-by-step kinds of stuff before it's going to really take off.